Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Cleantech podcast. Each week, our host David Hunt speaks to a leading startup CEO, executive, or thought leader in the cleantech sector. Focused on the clean energy and clean mobility transitions, each guest shares the highs and lows of their cleantech journey, their industry insights, and their vision and hopes for the future.
Hello, I'm David Hunt, CEO and founder of Hyperion Executive Search and your host for the Leaders in Cleantech podcast. Firstly, apologies for a delayed start to the new year. I've been in the US supporting the launch of Hyperion in the US. As you would have seen and heard from my US guests, we've been placing strategically important hires and building teams for clients in the US for some years now, actually. But after an 18-month COVID delay, we're finally able to build our own team on US soil. So if you are looking to hire or move on in your clean tech career in the US, please reach out to our head of North America, Robert Olson, or myself, of course, still very much actively involved in supporting the team there and the teams in Germany and the UK. But staying in the US, back to the podcast, my guest this week is Francis Wang, CEO of Nanograph. Nanograph is an advanced battery material startup and spin-out out of Northwestern University and Argonne National Laboratories. They're going through significant growth in terms of numbers and technologies, so it'd be a great story. Francis has an interesting path to entrepreneurship, as many of our guests do, a great pedigree in the battery space, so I hope you enjoy the episode. So Francis, hello, welcome to the Leaders in Cleantech podcast.
Good morning, David, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here, and just sharing beforehand that I've been in Florida, which is nice and warm and sunny. I'm back in the very cold UK, and you're in pretty chilly Chicago at the moment.
Yeah, it's about 5 degrees Fahrenheit outside right now, so not a winter wonderland here, I guess you could say.
Best thing to be inside listening or making a podcast. So, thanks very much for joining us. I think one of the things that's really fascinating in all of these episodes that I've done is the different journeys that people have taken to get to the point of being a CEO or a leader within a clean tech organization. So maybe we could start a little bit of that backstory of how you came from your studies and various places you've been through to joining Nanograph a number of years ago.
Yeah, I guess a good place to start would be, yeah, my educational background. So I'm a chemist by training, and I did my PhD with somebody actually in the UK, Claire Gray. She's at Cambridge University. And I finished my graduate degree in 1998 and got a job in industry at Duracell in the US in Boston, Massachusetts, which, you know, at the time was arguably one of the better, if not best, places if you wanted to work on batteries in North America to be. I mean, surrounded by, in terms of lithium ion battery history or people that have changed the industry. A number of my colleagues were some of the inventors of things like NMC and lithium iron phosphate, all of which are, you know, impacting the electric vehicle world today. I worked there for about 8 years, you know, all along working on R&D, also beginning to understand about battery production and all that goes along with that. And spent about 5 years working for a medical device company, and they had recruited me to help them produce a battery factory and also a cathode factory. So kind of transitioned from, you know, the R&D space, probably bigger D, smaller R, you know, downstream to things like battery production, cathode production, and all that goes along with that. And then after 5 years in the Midwest, I got an offer to help China and moved to China and Beijing for a clean energy institute. At the time, the Chinese government was keen on doing something about their, you know, their environmental issues. And so that has always been a passion of mine. And I spent 5 years working there. There were a number of Americans. It was actually a kind of a global effort. There were a number of Nobel Prize winners, et cetera, part of that organization, and did that for 5 years. I was director of an energy storage center there, focused mm-hmm. on getting grid-scale energy storage off the ground, projects, commercialized technologies, et cetera. After about 5 years of working in Asia and, you know, experiencing all the good and bad that goes along with that, I decided that, you know, I really wanted to pursue being an entrepreneur. And that was something mm-hmm. that I had dreamed about for a long time. Honestly, a little bit frightened to do that. But I think, you know, once I reached, you know, my 40s, I felt it was kind of, you know, now or never sort of moment. And, you know, I yeah. took the leap, moved back to Chicago to a company called Synode Systems. That name has been changed over the years. We're now Nanograph. And that is a silicon battery anode material. It's a material-based company. It was spun out of Northwestern. Essentially, you know, I'm sure some of your audience isn't familiar with silicon anodes, but they are a hot topic, have been for, you know, I would say about 7 or 8 years now in terms of, you know, most people understand that silicon anodes probably will be the driver of, you know, increased performance, particularly around energy density for lithium-ion batteries. And that's important, obviously, for electric vehicles where, you know, range anxiety and things like that have been, you know, historically an issue. So I've been here for, gosh, almost coming on 7 years now. I started as their COO. And moved to the CEO position about 3 years ago. So that kind of accelerates us to where we are today.
Yeah. No, it's you're far from unique, but it's an interesting journey from academia to sort of an R&D commercial environment through to then, as you say yourself, wanting to try out as an entrepreneur. But were there particular factors? I mean, obviously coming back to the US, I guess, was one factor in your mindset, but also was there a particular draw? Was there something earlier in your career when you thought of being an entrepreneur, but you held off for a little while? What was the appeal?
Yeah, there were always, I mean, for me, you know, icons like people like Steve Jobs, and then there were a ton of them, risk takers who, you know, jumped into entrepreneurship, made a big splash, obviously, and kind of moved the needle, if you will. And then more lately, folks like Elon Musk, very inspirational folks. I had always wanted to take a little bit more control of actually being able to get, you know, oftentimes when you work for a big company, making change or getting technologies out in the field, there are a lot of barriers that have nothing to do with whether or not the technology works or can make money, et cetera. And, you know, I always wanted a little more control over that, coupled with the fact that, always dreamed and admired people that were willing to take that risk and, you know, essentially move the needle or change the world. Those are always things that I dreamed of. And so kind of reached a point in my career where, you know, added to that a little bit homesick, and it seemed like the right time.
Yeah, and proved to be so far. Yeah, it's interesting in terms of, I think a lot of people in CEO positions, particularly in the sector where we're looking to move things forward, actually benefit from having come from a more corporate environment. There's a lot of talk, and we'll move on to that, in terms of cultures and how sort of agile and semi-chaotic a startup environment can be, which is great. And you do have to be able to live and breathe in that environment. But I think when your customers potentially are corporates, or your investors potentially are corporates, understanding a little bit of that environment and some of the bureaucratic challenges, or as you say, just the functional challenges of working in a larger organization, can be quite beneficial. Have you found that sort of stepping into an entrepreneur, that's been useful experience for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think working for big companies, there, you know, I think what has been useful, one item is just bringing processes to, you know, entrepreneurship or startup companies can often be chaotic, as you mentioned. And I think that's one of the things that I've been able to, you know, instill in Nanograph is a sense of process. And big companies are good at that, and they are fairly efficient. Obviously, there's many things that big companies don't do well, but that has been incredibly beneficial. And I've had to learn a ton, honestly. I think the first year or so of working at a startup was a bit of a shock to my system. Honestly, I think for about a year, I felt relatively useless in terms of, you know, just being able to adapt, but, you know, eventually did do that and kind of, I think, arguably have given my 10,000 hours and understand the entrepreneur world and what it takes to be successful in it.
Yeah. No, it's a good balance. I mean, you touched on already the technology, and silicon anodes are, as you said, an incredibly important part. We've worked with a handful of companies that are in that space, and it's, I think what's interesting is some people look at, certainly those outside of the sector potentially see the excitement around electric vehicles, which is fantastic, and lots of things and solar panels and things which are quite visual. But actually the material science world, I think, is fascinating, and some of these key material changes are really instrumental in, as you put it, moving the dial forward in the transition. So perhaps you can share a little bit about specifically Nanograph's technology, your goals and mission, and where you are on your journey.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned, the technology came out of Northwestern. It's an interesting story, actually. The founders were all students at the time. They'd taken a class that they teach at Northwestern where they put together Kellogg MBAs together with people doing their PhDs, so technical and business people together. They have them put together a business plan, and often, you know, the successful ones go on to try to raise money to actually build that company or that concept.
Right.
You know, our technology grew from graphene, which at the time, I think back in 2008 or 2009, was a very, very hot topic. It ultimately won the Nobel Prize. And we were, you know, our company and team was looking at ways to leverage graphene, you know, the unique properties that it has. It's a two-dimensional material, almost like a sheet of paper, if you will. Yeah. And one of the fundamental problems with silicon, people in the industry, the particles, when they charge, they expand. And one of the things that happens when it expands, it cracks and it loses connection. And one of the things we were thinking about was, hey, could graphene, if coated on the surface, prevent some of these historical failure mechanisms? For example, electrical disconnection. Because graphene is a two-dimensional material, and if you can imagine, as it expands, it slides. And when it slides, it still remains in electrical connection. And that was kind of the beginnings of the company. Obviously, the technology's evolved over the years. And based on what we have seen out in the field, we believe our product is actually the best silicon anode that is out there. We've been able to demonstrate that and, you know, recognize form factor, standard form factor, show that it actually has the world's most energy dense, or enables the world's most energy dense performance in a battery.
And in terms of that journey, because these things are never cheap to evolve, I mean, have you been involved in the fundraising process yourself whilst there? Because obviously there has been a lot of interest, as you say, in the last few years, a lot of investment into this particular area of technology. Has that been something that you've directly been involved with?
I have, but I will say Nanograph's taken a different approach to a material startup. I mean, our thesis has been over the years, there's a lot of startup companies that raise a ton of money, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, sometimes billions, and we have competitors that do that, not to throw them under the bus at all. I mean, it's one way of doing it. Certainly companies like Tesla will do that. We always felt that, you know, that we preferred to stay lean, and so raising funds has, you know, not been necessarily a priority. We've stayed relatively lean through the years, where I would say there was still a bunch of technology risk and product risk. What we did was we brought in non-dilutive funding. So not to throw figures out there, but I would say for the first 6-7 years of the company, we survived on government funding dollars. and brought in, you know, very, very little diluted funding. And I think that certainly sets us apart from the other folks that are out there. And certainly we reached the stage where having those funds is important in terms of growth and speed to market. So we are, you know, deep in the funding process, I'll say.
I think those things around timing for various different reasons, but there is always a counter argument that having too much money too soon, you know, makes you to some extent enables you to be inefficient. And sometimes when you are closer to a bootstrapping model, you tend to make the most of what you have and perhaps run, as you say, a leaner ship, which helps when you take money down the line so you're not sort of diluting too soon.
Exactly. I think, you know, that it is a classic failure of many companies in the clean tech space to overcapitalize themselves. They raise money beyond the value of their company. And that, you know, as you get deeper into it or further along, it does hurt you. And you can actually, as you say, raise more money than you need. It is not necessarily a good thing.
So where's the company at now in terms of the product evolution and sort of how far you are in the commercialization route? You now fully commercialized? Are you still sort of getting closer to that point?
Yeah, we're right on the edge of, you know, that inflection point, hockey stick inflection point, if you will. So over the last, I would say, 18 months or so, we have been able to scale the material, our current product, which we call G6. As I mentioned earlier, we've been able to demonstrate that in a battery. And most importantly, we've been able to get that battery out into the field. And our beachhead market, I will say, is the U.S. military. They like our product. Many of the folks in that military space, which is a great beachhead market, by the way, are interested and have we've signed a number of LOIs that demonstrate that traction. And where we are now is we are onshoring our production from Japan to the United States. We believe that there will be considerable momentum around building the battery supply chain in the United States. Our customer is always interested in national security, so that's also part of it. And where we are in the process today, we are about to build and expand our facility to 35 tons per year production capacity, and that should be available by the end of this year.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I mean, it's evolved a lot as the various OEMs have jumped on to the electrification of vehicles in particular, and around obviously the expansion of gigafactories and how close that you can shrink in the supply chain rather than extending it. And I think there's a benefit to localized, both having the gigafactories, but of course the material supply as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're seeing a lot of these gigafactories pop up, especially in the EU. I think, you know, they've made tremendous progress there. And I think North America, the US and Canada are a bit behind the EU, but, you know, I expect over the next 3 to 5 years, you'll see accelerated growth in our area.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you're right. In many areas of that sort of electrification, maybe because there are so many OEMs in the sort of EU region, but absolutely we've seen the US really escalate in the last couple of years, both in terms of batteries and obviously from the electric vehicle and charging infrastructure side of things. All of these things obviously contribute to the big drive, but it's around now, actually, how quickly can we charge and how quickly can we sort of make a more seamless experience for EV drivers, and clearly a faster charge is a key factor in that. Do you see, perhaps it's too early to look at internationalization when clearly there's a huge market evolving on your doorstep, but have you sort of plans over and beyond that?
Yeah, we really haven't reached that phase of thinking. Certainly there's been some conversations that we've had around that. I mean, for us, it's one step at a time. I think there's so much going on and so many things that we need to do right. The current focus, I would say, over the next 24 months is to make sure that we scale the material to the proper quality and it gets validated, and to get it out to the market. I think that's the most important thing. And we've been pre-revenue up until now. And bringing in that revenue, I think, is a game changer for the company. It opens a bunch of doors in terms of partnerships and getting even more product out to market. So we're keen on focusing on the U.S. for the moment.
In your role as CEO, sort of evolving from that COO to CEO role, clearly in some regards or wearing all of the hats at some point in time, what are the sort of the personal challenges that you see? If you touched on some of the technical challenges or the process that you're going through, what are some of the personal challenges that you've encountered or enjoy struggle with in the CEO capacity?
Yeah, it's and I tell people all the time, this is honestly, being an entrepreneur is the best job that I've ever had. We have an amazing team, and all the progress has been, something that I can hang my hat on. But, speaking of hats, needing to, it's a roller coaster ride. Anybody that's been an entrepreneur in a startup understands that. I mean, they're literally, I think our fate as a company sometimes can change moment to moment, day to day. And you have to ride that wave of emotions and realities and be able to be flexible and change. And I think that, for most people is a difficult thing, seeing something in front of you. And obviously there's a lot of emotions about, oh my God, everything just changed. And what do we do to solve that? You need to be able to react to that quite quickly. So, the ups and downs, these are all things that entrepreneurs go through. Oftentimes, it's been less for me that the challenges have been less about the technology, really. The technology and the science and engineering part of it to me are much easier than the other things, the outside world, the business, the market, the people, sometimes internal, sometimes external. That oftentimes is the more different part of the puzzle.
Yeah, very interesting from our perspective, working with people and clients on the evolution of teams. And obviously a lot of the companies we work with are very high growth. So there's always a challenge when you're hiring an awful lot of people in a quick period of time to be able to maintain cultures or create cultures. So it'd be interesting to see that, you've clearly worked in, I guess, leadership or management positions for some time. How, if your leadership style has changed or how is the culture within the business?
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily changed. I certainly think I've gotten better at it over the years. I mean, and this is just a generalization, but I think PhD scientists tend not to be people. We're often introverts and not extroverts. And yeah, it's been a lot of work for me. I mean, I've been, managing teams or leading teams for, over a decade now, probably closer to 15 years. Yeah, there's just been a number of learnings throughout that time, around leadership and also, inspiring others. It's about creating, the Steve Jobs terms of, creating a reality distortion field and bringing people along with you that believe in the mission as much as you do. And, at a startup, it's tough because you don't have a lot. You've got to strongly believe that the outcome is, it will be positive and in your favor, even when all other data says it won't be. And that's been the exciting part, but also the scary part. And managing people through those difficult times is, it's been one of the challenges, but something that I've learned to do over the years.
Yeah. And obviously these things have been exacerbated over the last couple of years with all that's been going on with COVID. So I guess you would have at least some remote workers or some sort of diversity in locations for where the team are. Is that something which, again, has been a challenge or something that you've had to work on to make sure that those people in different places are still part of the team and bought into that, I should say, that reality distortion?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the biggest challenges we've had. We, as the company grows, we have people honestly in all corners of the world, right? So we are on calls with Asia quite a bit at night, and we have people, most of them are in Chicago, but we have others that work in other places. I think, one of the difficult parts of, call it the hard sciences, is that we need to be in the lab. To be in the office is important. Yep. But that obviously over the last few years has been a challenge. But I have found, and this has been a learning in my career, that it's possible to do that and be productive, even though at times, you're not in the lab, so to speak,
yep.
or not in the office physically with others. And most of it really, I think, is about culture. You know, I had mentioned, this is the best team that I've ever worked for, and I think, or worked with. And yeah, I just think we have a wonderful culture. You know, when I turn my back, I know that things continue to happen, whether they're working at home or they're in the office in front of me. You know, people are passionate about what they do and believe in, you know, the change that we can exact in the field. And you know, they work passionately, whether that's at home or in the office.
Yeah, I think it's certainly, I guess, one of the advantages of being in the sector we are. So many people are in this for the impact that they make more than the money they make, or a combination, of course, of both of those things, but certainly around the impact. And yeah, having people that, I should say, will still get shit done wherever they are, however they are, but things happen and progress moves. But it's still, I find, quite difficult to keep team culture and those kind of, I guess, support mechanisms for everybody when you just can't physically interact as much as you might normally do. And I think that's been a challenge for most leaders. But do you do any kind of activities or any work specifically on trying to keep team culture strong?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a key component of it, right? You've got to, like I said, it's a roller coaster, and you have to give time to de-stress. A lot of that's focused around alcohol with our team, I think, and we'll head out and have a beer together. I think that's important outside of the workplace. You know, one interesting, I'm sure investors won't like hearing this, but you know, we have a policy of, you know, we have what you could call unlimited vacation, right? And I don't, perhaps it's not unusual. Every place that I've worked at always has a framework around that. We work so hard, and I tell folks, you know, understand yourself and where you are physically, emotionally, and if you need to take time off, do it. The rest of the team will pitch in. We'll make sure that nothing stops. You know, I think that's just one of the things that I've learned as an entrepreneur, that, yeah, you have to recharge, if you will. And yeah, we let folks do that whenever and however and as much as they need.
Yeah. No, I think it's an important thing. And you say you're not entirely unique. I know a few of our other clients do that. But I think that's one of the things that just flexibility to know people to take a break if they need to break, whether it's a morning or whether it's a couple of days or whatever it might be, that they can look after themselves in order to still be productive, I think is really important. And I think that's a bit of a disadvantage potentially as corporates, because that's relatively easy when there's a few dozen of you, maybe in a couple hundred of you. But when there's many thousands in the team, that's a little bit more difficult to manage, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, super okay. So looking to the future, you talked about sort of you're at the inflection point now with the commercialization of the product and obviously the growth that's going on. But if we perhaps take a slightly longer view, Francis, of where in the next, because things move so quickly, of course, but in the next maybe 3 to 5 years, both where you see Nanograph and where more broadly you see the evolutions in the battery and mobility spaces.
Yeah. It's a great question. You know, even though we're focused very much on the next 24 months, which I think are critical for the company, we are looking forward. You know, one of the aspects which, you know, I believe in, so we are in the process of what I called forward integrating. So we are a materials company, and, you know, with everything that's going on in the world, particularly driven by electric vehicles, I think partnerships are important. Being able to get your product to market is important. So, you know, being able to control to some extent cell production is important for a materials company to be able to get your technology on the field. And that's very difficult, especially since you see many, you know, vertical integration or partnerships along the value chain, where it's very easy for smaller companies to get locked out. Right. You know, for example, Samsung or LG has their preferred anode supplier. And if you are not that anode supplier, it can be difficult. And you're seeing more and more of that happen. Everything from materials and mining all the way down to the OEMs, the producers of the vehicles. That's all been accelerated by the pandemic with all the supply chain issues, I think. The forward-looking smart money, if you will, has locked down their supply chain, right? So they know where they're getting their lithium from, et cetera, just because it is going to be harder for folks to get components and materials and technologies. I think that's a trend that will probably, you know, take us through the next 24, 36 months, but I doubt that that will change over time. I think EV manufacturers, we're still learning, you know, in the battery space, what's important for electric vehicles, right? We're seeing currently a shift. For example, people care less about range and more about cost. I think, you know, and that's somewhat natural in terms of, you know, you have these fancy electric vehicles, but we're moving mainstream, and to hit those kinds of markets, you've got to get the battery down to a cost that makes sense for your average consumer. And they're moving that way. And forming partnerships all the way along. So, you know, in terms of what's important for NanoGraph, I think beyond 24 months, is Ford integrating into the battery space? I think that's important. It's strategically important. Other things that we think down the road, things like recyclability. So we make a material that honestly today, I don't know if it's recyclable. But I would imagine in the longer term, call it 5 years and beyond, battery producers will have a preference for materials that can be recycled or that drop in, if you will, to you know, their processes around recycling. And so, you know, we also look at things like that, beginning, you know, in the lab to think about that, you know, in order to provide a value proposition down the road, which is not necessarily focused around performance. Always performance is important, but there are other things beyond performance and cost, things like recyclability, I think, will play into it. So we think about that too long term.
Well, the broader battery market, having seen, obviously, you worked previously more on the stationary, as I understand it, in China, was sort of a lot around stationary storage, which now, of course, is now mandated in many states and is increasingly prevalent. And of course, I mean, have you been surprised a little bit by how quickly some of the US OEMs, particularly the big truck, the F-150s, for example, that are increasingly, we've seen great things from the likes of Rivian, but it seems now pretty much every OEM in the US now is really accelerating that journey. And that surprised me a little bit from a number of reasons. Gas is so cheap in the US compared to how it is in Europe and many other things. But that must really, I guess, both create great opportunity and sort of make you happy, but also lots of challenges because things are moving so quickly.
Yeah, when you take a step back, it is impressive how quickly things are moving. You know, companies like Rivian and Lucid have done an amazing job of getting products that are quite sexy and people want. You know, the supply chain issues, I think, are going to hurt everyone, particularly the smaller outfits like Lucid and Rivian, even though they're growing rapidly. But just getting things like batteries, I think may slow things down. I could be wrong. You know, the supply chain, it's a disaster right now. I mean, the smaller folks can't get the batteries that they need. And I think that's going to ultimately impact the speed at which things can grow. But it is inspiring, and I'm glad to see that we're moving away from fossil fuels. And I think electric vehicles are a big part of that. It's also quite well known that the U.S. government now, you know, is trying to push through legislation that supports all of that. And I think, as a country, perhaps a little bit late to the table, but this is the right direction, you know, as a country. You know, and all the climate change issues that we have, moving forward with electric vehicles is the right way. And I'm glad to see that it's moving as fast as it is.
Yeah, I think, again, in some way, there's a perfect storm that we have people much more, I guess, aware, even those who would like not to be aware, much more aware of the issues around climate change because of the impacts, particularly in the US, you know, wildfires and storms and everything else that are occurring. But also, thanks to companies like yours, reducing the cost of everything. You got that kind of, on one hand, the drive from a social level of we've got to do something. On the other hand, it's just become much more cheaper to get solar or to get an electric vehicle or to do these things, so, which is all great to see. A lot of us have worked very hard to get to this point.
It's exciting times. I mean, Yeah, I'm looking forward to the next decade, the changes that we'll see not only with electric vehicles, but just the grid. I mean, you know, clean tech moves so slowly, right? And that's oftentimes entrepreneurs and investors don't realize how slow things move. It is a big wheel, right? And but it's great to finally see some change, the needle moving. Electric vehicles, I think, are just the beginning. And as energy storage decreases in cost, and we can offer solutions to the grid, I think you're going to see, you know, the impact of that, you know, even more so. And hopefully it continues to move at the speed it is.
We touched on this a few times, Francis, in terms of the having moved into entrepreneurship and some of the perhaps the biggest what's been most rewarding for you in the last few years? We talked a little bit about the challenges, but what's been most rewarding for you in leading an organization like Nanograph?
It's been a great passion. You know, I think those moments are few that you have a win. I think what makes it so rewarding is that you fight for so long, oftentimes years, to prove something. I'll give you an example. You know, when we proved out our technology in an 18650 cell, and we actually hit like the world's most energy dense battery, somewhere between 800 and 830 watt hours per liter. That was a moment where I actually had to, you know, when we got off the phone, I think there was a tear in my eye. It was amazing. And, you know, those moments are few and far between oftentimes, and the distance between them is long. But it's when you hit those things and you fight, and you know, it's just knowing that, you know, myself and the team, we all walk away knowing that we played a role in that, a significant role in changing that. And I think that's been a big difference for me. When you work at a, you know, a much larger company and the product launch, you know, obviously you do participate in that, but you sometimes you don't quite feel it, right? I mean, you're one of thousands of people that contributed to a product. I mean, here were a handful of people that contribute to something. And so, yeah, the feeling's magnified, and, you know, it's what keeps me going. I think sometimes I say it's a little bit like playing golf. You know, I'm not a great golfer, but I love it. And occasionally I will hit the ball just right, and it'll go 250 yards, and that keeps me coming back. And being an entrepreneur is a little bit like that.
Yeah, that's a really good analogy. Actually, I was on a golf course in Florida last week with Robert, who's heading up our Hyperion team there, and he's a really good golfer. But again, it was exactly the point that it doesn't happen very often, but when you catch one right, that makes it all worthwhile.
Exactly, yeah.
So, cool. Okay, so in terms of motivations, you've touched on a couple of, you mentioned Steve Jobs, you mentioned Elon Musk, who clearly are icons, and there's a lot to learn from what they achieved. But are there sources of inspiration for you, whether that's individuals, or I always look for sort of recommendations of perhaps books or places that you've gone to that have helped you on your journey or that have inspired you on your journey?
Yeah, absolutely. There's lots of readings along the way. I mean, the book that I love and often go to is The Hard Thing About the Hard Thing and Hard Things. And, you know, there's so much in that book that, you know, rings true. Yeah, you go, yeah, I've actually lived this, experienced this. There's been, you know, the journey is filled with mentors along the way, teachers, advisors, colleagues that, you know, turn into mentors, people that admire different aspects in different ways, you know, have kind of shaped who I am today as a CEO. Yeah. All along the way. And these have been people younger than me, older than me. I mean, I'll say our team is relatively young. I don't often tell them this, but I'm always learning from them. I mean, I'm 52 years old, and there's a bunch of things. I often don't know why my computer doesn't work, or the latest app, or what's cool these days. And, you know, being around them, it's inspirational, honestly, and it keeps me going too. I mean, it's a fun part of the job. And, you know, it's great to see how fast they learn and adapt. I only wish that I could be that fast at 52 years old, but they're an inspiration too.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I feel your pain, by the way. So that's the advantage of having a young team around you to do many of these things.
For sure.
Cool. Well, it's been a real blessing to have some time with you, Francis. Thanks for sharing that. We're on the episode page for the podcast. We'll point to your website and various places and that people can access and look at what you're looking to achieve, and or the book recommendation, which is a great book, and we'll make sure that that's hooked up. So if people want to have an experience of that, they can do that. But in the meantime, really looking forward to seeing your evolution continue over the next few years, and to see the success of the company.
Appreciate that, David. Thank you so much. It's been fun.